Before we start this very important podcast, we have a public service announcement to make. Today is the 19th of November 2021. And the reason I mention that date and the significance is because it's Georgina Steinle's birthday! Happy birthday, Georgina!
Boy.
And looking for a fan of her stuff and bird photography, she's actually doing a book signing tonight at the Bunker Gallery, and this is for her new book, which has been published by Australian Geographic. And if you're into bird twitching or whatever you guys call it, I'll go and check that out because that would be some very sweet action. That's on at the Bunker Gallery. That's 5 Coolgardie Terrace in Perth. And if you want to go to that, get in touch with Team Digital. Again, happy birthday, Georgina. All the best.
Talking Photography with Kristen Fletcher and Cohen.
Kristen Fletcher and Cohen.
Talking Photography.
Crossing live to Hannah Alberta, and we're going to speak to, Canada's biggest export since Nickelback, Chris Malloy. Come on down.
I think Nickelback still might take the cake on that, but I'll take it.
Wow, yeah. Hey, Chris. Hang on. Is that where Nickelback come from, Carwin?
Yes.
Hannah.
Yep.
This town. And so, but Chris, you're not in Hannah, are you?
I am not in Hannah. I'm a couple of hours from Hannah, but
right.
I've been there and shot quite a bit there, actually.
Yeah. And you, what did you do there? Shot.
Took photos. Yeah, took photos.
Oh,
no,
okay.
Nothing gun related.
Yeah. that was one question I had to ask. Do they have lots of guns in Canada, or is it more like Australia?
No, it's much more like Australia, I think. It's much different than the US in that capacity, for sure.
No, that's boring.
Yeah.
We had an American guy on, and he's got a couple of AR-15s that he'd like to show us, so that was interesting.
Dave, we're looking at you.
He went shooting in multiple ways when he went out exploring the wilds. But look, you explore the wilds, but they're kind of the urban wilds, and I've been following your work for quite a while now, and I just love what you do. I love that style, and I think it was because I was getting into that style myself that I was looking at stuff on Instagram, and somehow your work came across my feed, and I just immediately fell in love with it. So, it's good to see what you do and all that stuff. But one thing that did concern me, and we did have, Carl and I had this conversation last week about film versus digital, and I
tuned into that episode, yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that, mate, because we probably upset you. you did a lecture back in 2017 on why you still shoot film. Can you enlighten us a little bit? Because I need to be told, where I'm going wrong.
You know what, truth be told, I ask myself the same question sometimes, and I go back and forth with the answer, to be honest.
Mm. Yeah.
I started shooting film about 6 years ago or so, and I still do. I shoot both. I shoot digital, and I shoot film as well.
Mm. Yeah.
And I just found that for my process, I really loved using the film cameras.
Mm-hmm.
I find them so interesting. That's part of what sort of keeps my attention in photography is learning about the gear and getting to use new things. Mm-hmm. And there's so many strange and interesting film cameras out there that are really fantastic and really specialized when you compare that to sort of what's available digitally these days.
Yeah.
And I really fell in love with the process, and it's slow, and it is more expensive for sure. I mean, you can do a variety of things and make it a little more affordable for yourself. But as far as aesthetics go, what I was getting or what I was trying to do to digital files, I was finding that when I shot film and compared them, I would work on digital files to make them look like what the film files were looking like with very little work at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it started off as an aesthetic choice, and then it just became just sort of a hobby and a fun set of things to learn about. And I'm sort of just way down the rabbit hole now. And
Chris, can I ask you just a technical question? And we don't tend to get bogged down in the technical stuff too much, but I have to ask you, a lot of your stuff is, we would class that as urban banal, a lot of houses and that sort of thing. And, I mean, the photography is stunning, But I'm just wondering, do you use a tripod at all, or are you shooting handheld? And if you are shooting handheld, how? Like, you know, what's your ISO on your film?
Well, it so let me unpack that a little bit. So yes, I use a tripod a lot of the time. Mm. It depends on the camera that I'm shooting. It depends on the time of day, or more importantly, the light that's available,
yeah,
and how that corresponds to different shutter speeds that I need to use.
Because a lot of it's nighttime stuff, isn't it?
A lot of it's nighttime stuff. Sometimes I should be using a tripod when I chose not to, and then you get home and develop the film and realize that you're the proud owner of a whole roll of blurry film because you're too lazy to get the tripod out. But yeah, I use a variety of different speeds of film. I shoot primarily expired film, and that's something that I sort of go back and forth on. It's a love-hate relationship. It started off because I could get it for really cheap. At that time, 6 or 7 years ago especially, people were offloading huge amounts. Like, you know, there were pros that were just selling freezers full of film because they had switched over to digital and it was worthless to them. And so I would buy it for a couple of dollars a roll, and I've always developed all my own film here. And so, you know, my total cost per roll to shoot and develop might have been $2 or $3 or $4 compared to like $20 a roll for a fresh film. And so it started off as a way to keep things affordable. But so I've always shot a variety of different film and a variety of different speeds. Generally, I shoot slower speed film because I find that it ages better. Just in terms of over time, film can color shift a little bit, but more importantly, it loses sensitivity to light. So if you have an 800 speed film that's 20 years old, it is not going to shoot at 800 ISO 20 years later. You have to shoot it, and there's rules of thumb that say like for every 10 years you have to add a stop, but really, it totally depends on how that film was stored and you know, if it was in a fridge that whole time, it's different. If it was in your glove box or your car, it's different. But I find that the slower speed you go, the less correction you have to make to the film speed, and just the more integrity it still has over time. So it's also finer grain, and I just like the way generally that slower film speeds work. So most of it is I'm shooting at an ISO of 100 or 50, depending on what that film is. And regarding the tripod, so some cameras you need to have a tripod. So if it's a 4x5 camera, like a large format camera, you basically have to be in a tripod. There are a few rangefinder iterations of 4x5s, but not the one that I have. So in that instance, you always need to be on a tripod, day or night. The rest of the time, if it's daytime, I have a Mamiya RZ67. That's sort of my main shooter, and I shoot that handheld a lot of the time.
Yep.
But as soon as the light goes down, I can't just jack up the ISO on it.
No.
So I'm pretty buckled down to a tripod as soon as the sun goes down.
Yeah.
So film is basically, it's an aesthetic choice. It's part of your creative process. Apart from enjoying the whole process of, you know, slowing down and all that, you like the look that you get from film specifically.
I really like the results that I get from it. Yeah, and I find that there's a something that pairs well with the subject matter that I shoot and the look from expired film, especially. And sometimes it's a little more unpredictable than fresh film, certainly, and certainly less predictable than digital. But sometimes you get something that's really, it is unpredictable, but it's better than you thought that you were going to come back with. So when you get one of those, it's, you know, it's sort of like a great golf shot. You can have an awful round and hit one good shot at the end, and then you're happy about your day.
And actually, that you were right about your subject matter and how the film kind of enhances that, because you look at your stuff that you're photographing, and it looks like it was photographed back in the 50s or the 60s or the 70s. You know, it's got this sense of nostalgia. Is that what you're looking for? Is that because a lot of the buildings that you shoot are kind of old and a little bit run down? Is that part of it?
Yeah, that's definitely part of it. And I've always sort of tried to create these scenes, to look for these scenes that exist in the modern world that look like they could be from another time. And sometimes there's like a little modern element in them, but in a lot of the places out here in rural Western Canada, especially, there's a lot of little vignettes that you can find in a little town or in a landscape that you, there are no identifiers of anything that has changed in the last 40 or 50 years. Mm. And I think that there's something interesting about finding something like that, like a window into the past that exists today.
Mm. Yeah. Chris, would you say that using the old film stock is actually added to your aesthetic?
Yeah, I would say so. And that's sort of what I've built my aesthetic kind of values around. I really like the way that it looks. And don't get me wrong, sometimes the photos come out and they're absolute dog shit. And I mean, those don't see the light of day very often, but every once in a while you look back on a role that you shot 3 years ago and there's something that at the time you're sort of frustrated with how it turned out, whether it was too grainy or the colors were weird or there was light leaks or something else screwed up. But you look at it with fresh eyes years later and you're like, oh, that's kind of interesting. It kind of adds to it a little bit more, but, I mean, generally I like to know what I'm going to be getting, but sometimes you appreciate those happy little accidents years later.
Mm. Yeah. And look, you do it of shooting at nighttime. I wouldn't say it was half or maybe half of your work shot at night. Do you, you're shooting in suburbs, you're shooting people's houses and stuff like that. How do you get around doing that without, you know, looking a little bit weird, a bit creepy, a bit stalkerish? Do you get permission from these people first or do you just go out and do it? You know, it's like, oh.
How do I get away without looking like that? I don't think I do necessarily.
You just do it.
I just do it. And I mean, I do it in a very respectful way. You know, I'm not ever trying to take a photo of someone's home to see something inside. It's always about the sort of how it's looking from the outside. And generally, if there are people there, and I do portrait work and stuff as well, but generally for my art stuff, I don't like to have people in the photos in general. So if there are people there, then I don't shoot it. But I have a long list of sort of run-ins and incidents that have happened over the years as a result of that. A lot of curious people, and rightfully so. But I'm always happy to stop and have a chat and explain myself and. Sometimes that works out and they feel better and sometimes it doesn't at all.
Because it is. It's. I mean, I love that look at nighttime of a suburban scene. You get a light on inside the house, you know, like an old car that's sitting there in the driveway. So obviously you're going around and you're finding these scenes. Do you kind of just see it and then stop and get the camera out and start shooting or do you scope it beforehand and...
Sort of a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B, and sometimes you can drive around and sort of do some location scouting in the daytime. But if you're planning to shoot it at night, what it looks like in the day does not necessarily give you a good idea of what it's going to look like at night. And so a lot of the time you're going to, like, what I'm looking for is interesting light. And because it doesn't matter how interesting a building or car or landscape or scene is, if the light doesn't look good when you're about to shoot it, it doesn't matter how interesting of a subject it is, especially at night when it's in the pitch black.
Yeah, it's got a very Gregory Crudson look about it. Are you influenced by guys like him? Have you seen much?
Yeah, certainly. He's one of my absolute favorites, and I've got a couple of books of his. And I remember he was a guy whose work I saw initially, and it was sort of my introduction into what medium and large format photography was, and then that sort of film aesthetic as well. And I remember just looking at, I saw some of his work and just the immense amount of detail that are in his prints and how large they're printed. You know, for whatever reason, I was like, my pictures don't look like this. Why, what is he doing differently that I'm not? And you're like, oh, it's 8x10. You're like, oh, what's 8x10? And then you look at the film real estate of an 8x10 piece of sheet film compared to a 35mm sensor, and it's off the charts as far as what it can translate. But yeah, he's his photos are all, they're, I'm hugely influenced by it just in terms of how he uses lighting, and he's much more of a, he's a creator from the ground up, because he creates these scenes. And so it may look like, you know, an old Midwest mill town at night where there's a car that he has found. But really the behind the scenes of that is that there are 40 different cinema lights on cranes and booms, and you know, the fire department has come through that street and soaked the street down, and like, you know, there's a full-size film crew of people that have produced this scene to capture this one image. And but that's sort of, you know, I'm always looking for elements of that that exist on their own more organically, partially just because I don't have the level of organization or budget to create a scene like that. But yeah, it's a different approach to the same result.
Yeah, and look, I look at your stuff and I consider it as good as what he's doing. The lighting, I mean, you don't have, if you're just using natural light, I think it's great the way you're using it. It's stylized perfectly. The scenes, just, they look, you know, there's something about that look of that, you know, that naturally lit landscape. And you seem to be using, you know, I'm not sure, it looks to me like you're photographing just after the sunset and beyond that. And there's some that are where it's pure black, but you also have that bit of detail in the sky still, which is kind of nice, that twilighty light when, you know, people have made dinner and they're just sitting down to eat, or they're about to, you know, or they're finished, they're about to put the TV on and just kick back. And I do love that whole aesthetic. Are you, have you looked much into the new topographics movement? Is that another influence?
Yeah, I mean, that's something, the sort of man-made structures and its influence on the landscape and how that sort of interacts with the natural world is something that I look at a lot too. And you know, you can see a lot of differences. I find things very interesting as far as how, what our new modern architecture looks like versus architecture from the 80s versus architecture from the 50s. And then out here in the prairies, I mean, there's a lot of architecture that is from, you know, the early 1900s, and it's still around. And so I love seeing that progression over time. And, you know, it's always, the question is always like, will I look back on photos of modern buildings today, 30 years from now, with the same affection that I look at, you know, something from the 70s or whatever, or the 50s now? Or is it just...
That's interesting.
Is it different? Is it just cool because it's old? Or, you know, will the things now age as well as things did from 50 years ago?
I don't reckon they will.
I'm not convinced that it will.
No.
But...
It is... But yeah, things like the cars, you know, like I think about the cars that I was driving when I first learned to drive, you know, however many years ago that was, can't remember now. But they at the time they were kind of modern, but you know, yeah, they've been there for a long time. They were nothing. If you saw one of those cars in the street, you wouldn't give it a second thought. But now those cars that are, you know, say 30, 40 years old are starting to look cool. They're starting to get that, like, oh yeah, okay. So maybe it will be like it, but yeah, I agree with the, you know, the architecture now is a lot different, and I like the you know, the 50s, 60s, and 70s architecture because it was not real fancy, it wasn't ornate, it was kind of simple, probably cost effective way of producing a building, and that's got a real charm about it, and I see that in a lot of your work, is some of the buildings are really average, you know, in regards to
architecture.
But that's the
and that's sort of the cars that I like too. It's not necessarily, you know, a polished hot rod from the 60s. I like much more sort of, you talked about that everyday kind of banal look, and that's the same for buildings and cars as well. But I don't think, you know, a 2017 Hyundai Accent is going to be cool in 2050.
No.
But, you know, I've been wrong before, so it wouldn't be the first time.
But
we'll find out.
It does make you wonder, though, because, funnily enough, we touched on this last week too, because I think they're building a 60-story apartment tower in front of the gallery. Fletch, is that right?
Yeah, or? Six stories.
Same sort of thing. But you wonder about the architecture, you know, is it going to be any good? I mean, we all know now they like to build big white slabs because they're relatively future-proof. So you wonder in 20 years' time, and they'll still be there, do they then become banal because they are banal to begin with? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I think we're just building crap, is what I'm getting at.
I don't
necessarily disagree with that either. Like, a lot of the things that I'm photographing that I find charming now are not like architectural works of art. But there's just, you know, a certain charm that I think they have. And but, you know, does a new stucco duplex have that? Maybe not. Maybe it will in 30 years. Who knows?
I'm looking at a photo now of on your Instagram page, and it's quite a way down the feed, but you've got a...
Don't go too deep.
Oh, no, here. Deep's good. No, I like all your stuff, mate. But it's got just the back end of a green car. I'm not sure what sort of car it is, but all your cars are very similar look. You must search those ones out. They're kind of that sedan or saloon. I'm not sure what you call them over there, but it's, you know, it's kind of got that squarish, long shape. But there's a building in there. There's a person walking in front. I don't know if it's a house or some sort of motel, but it's looks like 70s architecture. But in the background, you've got this modern building, this high rise building that's got it's all modern architecture. And it's got, you know, it's not a bad looking building, but I love that in that shot, you've captured, this scene. But when you look at the foreground, it looks like it was shot, you know, 40 years ago, and then you see the big building in the background, which is all modern, and you go, oh, okay. So
that's kind of a funny one. That was a little scene that was about 3 blocks from my house, strangely. And I think the building's about 100 years old, and the car's about 50 years old, and then it kind of works its way through, and you can see the modern buildings in downtown behind it. That was one of the few times I put a person in the frame, and sometimes I like to live dangerously, so.
And you got a hashtag baby steps.
That's right.
Actually, before we go on, for the kids playing along at home, how can they access your Instagram, Chris, so they can check out your stuff as we
My Instagram handle is at Mr. Malloy, all spelled out, MisterMalloy.
Yeah, Mr. Have a look, guys, because it's really cool stuff. It's interesting. It's stuff that I've been into. And my biggest problem is I live in a relatively scenic part of the world where we don't have much of this urban banal stuff. I have to search for it everywhere, and it's so hard to find. But that's why I look at where you are and what you've got, and I'm jealous as all hell because I just want to get out and shoot what you're shooting. And I've got beautiful beaches with.
Yeah, we've got. I live in. I'm originally from Eastern Ontario in Eastern Canada, and I moved to Calgary about 15 years ago. It's an interesting city. It's fairly isolated too, but it's a city of over a million people. And it's a big modern city, but to the west of us, an hour you have the Rocky Mountains. And then in all sort of the other directions, it's prairies and badlands very quickly as soon as you get out of the city. So probably a 30-minute drive or less from my front door, I can be in a farmer's field. Yep. And then there are all these little towns that are all fairly close to one another. You know, like you can go little town to little town within, 20, 50 minutes of each other. And so there's lots to see in those towns as well, where kind of the past has been maybe not preserved, but definitely not updated. Within a few hundred kilometers, and I've sort of photographed a lot within about a 1,000-kilometer radius of here now. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of little towns with that architecture that you're talking about. But definitely where I live in the city is just a regular modern city. Yeah. And I don't shoot in the city as much as I used to anyway.
You're just lucky, man. You've got, and I say this about my friends. I got a friend who lives in Oklahoma, and she's surrounded by all this stuff, and I'm going, oh man, it's where my heart lies. I'd love to be able to get out and just photograph that stuff. But hang on, you're like I said, you're an hour or so from the Rocky Mountains and some of the most amazing scenery in the world.
For sure.
But you don't shoot it, or do you shoot it and we just never see it?
I shoot it sometimes. And what I've found too is that there are people that shoot mountain landscapes really, really, really well. And you know, a lot of that is about getting to sort of extreme vantage points. It's a lot depends on like the weather and atmospheric conditions. So, you know, the people that live up there that are shooting this all the time get just like unbelievable images that, you know, you sort of think, well, why bother competing with this? I can't touch that. I'm not someone who's out there shooting it every day, but I have tons of pictures of the mountains and things too, but that's not where my general interest and passion lies when it comes to making photos.
Yeah, I can see that with your Instagram feed. It's just, you know, it's great stuff. So do you do photography as a full-time occupation, or are you doing something else to...
I don't. No, photography for me has always just been, it's been sort of a hobby and my kind of side hustle. I do a variety of, like, you know, from commercial stuff to, I've done some weddings. I do, you know, some advertising work. I was with a gallery for a few years and sell prints and... But my day job is I'm a teacher, so that's where that's where the Mr. Malloy comes from.
Right. Okay, I was wondering what that was all about.
Yeah, what? I teach little like grade 5 and grade 6 kids. I've done that for 15 years, so that's my day job. And then this is just my, you know, how I get out of the house, and it keeps me out of the bar.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Well, yeah. I mean, it's nice to have photography as a passion, because there's so much you can do with it. And look, I love your work. I think you should be out selling like Crudson. You know, I think he sells his stuff for $1 million a print or something like that. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? I mean, if we could all do that. But you know,
and I don't know if it was him or someone else, maybe Jeff Wall or something. But they were talking about when they sell these big prints, and these are like 12 by 8 foot prints, like they're gigantic. And he cuts up the original negative, like the original piece of film that it's shot on, and cuts it into 12 or whatever, if there's an edition of 12 prints, and you know, attaches part of that sheet film to the back of the print itself, so you like get a piece of the original to know that it's never been replicated.
That's a pretty cool way of doing it.
It's kind of like NFTs are trying to do that sort of stuff now, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right, all that sort of stuff.
But then we
That's a strange world that I can't quite wrap my head around. But.
Isn't it? I figured out the other day, and you might think I'm a genius for doing this, but why don't we just take a screenshot of an NFT?
So what, the screenshots of NFT? Like a screenshot, Carmen's been doing this really creative work of late, so I reckon, Carmen, your work, you know, it's definitely got to be an NFT. You just got to find someone now that's prepared to spend lots of money on your
stuff. Well, we just got to actually find out what it actually is, an NFT. That would be
creative. He's a creative genius, our boy, Carmen. He's
It's all true. It's all true.
Chris, it's all true. It's all true.
Chris, everything I've heard is true.
Looking at sorry, you go, Fletch.
Yeah, mate.
Oh, look, I was going to say, look, you are, from what I can gather, looking on Google Maps, you're about 2 hours away from the United States.
Maybe 3 hours, but yeah, we're just above Montana.
Are you ever tempted to sort of, you know, do a day trip down to Wyoming or something like that?
Certainly, I've been to Wyoming. I think I was in Wyoming before I took photos, but I've shot a lot in Montana. I've shot a lot in, my parents have a place in Florida that we go to, once a year. So I've done a lot of photos around there and in upstate New York, which is closer to where I'm from. But yeah, we go to the States fairly regularly. Other than the last 2 years, the border has been closed, but it just opened up about a week ago.
So you were so lucky. If I'm actually in Perth and Christian is in Dunsborough, so if I drive for a couple of hours, I just end up in Dunsborough, which is
three hours.
Yeah. Which is awesome. Yeah, but that's it.
Well, to put it in context, Western Australia, which is the state we live in, is about a third of the size of America.
Right.
So, you know, if that's our state. If we go from the bottom of Western Australia to the top of Western Australia, it's about 4,000 kilometers or something stupid like that. It's just
Wow. Yeah.
It's huge distance. But most of it's desert. So this is the difference. I mean, I guess Canada's a bit like that as well, isn't it? There's a lot of...
It has some more arid parts for sure. Yeah. Nothing that's quite desert. There's some badlands that's sort of deserty, but nothing that's straight desert or quite as warm as you get down there. But there's definitely a vast landscape, like vast difference in the landscape when you go from edge to edge in Canada.
So you've got a lot of options. I mean, you can go north, you can go west, east, south into the United States. Canada's probably one of the best places to be if you're into photography, I reckon.
There's certainly lots of options, and I mean the United States, there's tons of options as well, and especially when you get into that sort of Wyoming, South Dakota pocket of landscape in there where like Yellowstone Provincial Park is and Grand Tetons and things. The amount of variance in the landscape within only a couple of hours is wild. But we have that here too, where it goes from prairies literally right up to the mountains. And within an hour's drive, it's there's lots to see here as well, definitely.
I was in Canada. I was in Calgary, actually. I spent a couple of days there. About 22 years ago, I was over there traveling around Australia. America. And just in a van that I bought with my girlfriend at the time. And we pulled into Canada and went through what's the national park right on the border? Really nice. Glacier National Park?
Is it Glacier? Yeah, there's Glacier National Park that's half in Canada, I believe, and half in Montana,
Yeah, we came in through there, and on the way across, I was really worried about coming into Canada because we were somewhere, I don't know if it was Wyoming.
Were you carrying dope? Did you have dope?
I wasn't carrying dope.
No dope in the van?
But I got a couple of funny stories about crossing the border in Canada, but the first one
they
was...
involve dope?
We were... No. I hit a car. So I was... So we were
all signs are pointing back to the dope.
This is sounding like an episode of Trailer Park Boys.
Stoned out of my mind, and I hit a car.
I hit a car.
Yeah, and I parked in the car, and I hit this other, just knocked the front end of this car and put a dent in it. Anyway, we stopped, and I was sitting there, and I said to my girlfriend, I said, "Well, what are we going to do? Like, we've got no insurance, I don't think, and how's this all going to work? We're leaving the country today." And so we sat there for a couple of minutes waiting for the owner to come back, and they didn't. So my girlfriend just got a bit of paper and just stuck it under their windscreen wiper in case someone saw us do it.
What did the paper say?
Like, we left it. Nothing.
Fuck you.
I might have said sorry. We bolted, and we had one night in some national park or some state park just before we left to get into Canada, and I was expecting that they were going to get me at the border. There was going to be the Americans.
Certainly,
there.
Yeah.
They got my number. They're going to put me in jail, and I was freaking out. So,
what sort of car was it, Fletch? Yeah. Was it a Rolls Royce?
It was a Mexican smuggling mobile. It was literally
a
Ford Transit van. We had no windows. Yeah. It was all solid metal.
Yeah.
So it had no windows in the back at all.
You're lucky
and
you
didn't have
smoked.
Number plates.
Yeah.
Our number plates didn't arrive the whole time we were away because we had to get it re-registered for some reason. So we just had a bit of paper saying that it's actually licensed.
This was your ride.
Not suspect at all.
So we got three times by the cops for going around without number plates and stuff. And they did check us for drugs, but of course I'm not a druggo, so I didn't have any on me, but yeah.
Right.
And the other one, when I came recently, I was dropping my mate off into Banff, and I went from America into Canada just for one night. So it was kind of like, I hope this is not going to look really sus. I'm just coming in, dropping off my mate the next day. Anyway, I came back, and the lady at the immigration, the Canadian lady, goes, "Oh, where are you from?" I said, "I'm from Australia." She goes, "Oh, can you say banana?" I said, "Yeah, banana." And she goes, "Nah," she thought it was great. "Okay, see you later."
just relax. You say
that's a tremendous Canadian accent, by the way.
It sounded like South Carolina, but say tomato. How do you say tomato, Flesh?
Tomato.
Yeah. Sorry,
that's a tomato, isn't it?
Tomato.
Yeah, tomato. Tomato.
Yeah. But do you get shitty when people say, "What part of America are you from?" Or.
It's that's a in general, sort of that's like a European and other parts of the world thing. They're like, oh, from America, like, and you're like, well, North America, I guess, but we don't really refer to Canada as America, even though it is part of North America, which I realize can be confusing.
Yeah.
But no, most people just don't know. I try not to get too fired up about it.
Do you know what the Americans seem to? I've got a mate of mine is from Maine, and Dave, his name is, and he actually might be listening, but we call him Canadian Dave, and he hates it.
Well, I mean, Maine
is basically Canada.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I've been there as well. But so anyway, we pulled into Calgary, and I think we're a week out from the Stampede.
Oh yeah,
so you guys would have done that. You would have done that before, I'm sure.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is that a good fun week or weekend or whatever it is?
Yeah, it's a 10-day piss up. And I mean, it is what it is. There's a lot of cowboy culture around here. That's not necessarily something that I identify with tremendously, being originally from Eastern Ontario. But it's a lot of fun. I mean, I like drinking beer and music as much as the next person. There's a lot of it that I can get behind, and it's a lot of interesting sort of Western cultural events that you can go and see, from you know, bull riding to cattle penning to, you know, a variety of different ways that you can torture animals, I guess. But it's a lot of fun, and they had to not do it for the first year, for the first time in like 100 years or something, for COVID, and then they did end up doing it last year again. But it's an interesting event to attend for sure.
Now, I'll tell you what is interesting too. We often forget that Canada is a part of the Commonwealth, and you know, shares a lot of the lingo with the rest of the Commonwealth. You know, such as piss up. I think it was one of the terms you used just a few seconds ago. Which is quite amazing, because if you say that to an American, if you say, hey, we're going to go and do a piss up, they'll be like, come on, man. Like, isn't that illegal? Like a piss up?
Far out, man. You can't pee outside. You can get a ticket for that.
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, boys. Just picked up on that.
Yeah, no. Well, I mean, and I have a variety of friends here that are from all over the place, from Eastern Canada to Australia to the UK. And so, you know, it's a big cultural melting pot around here. And so your terminology just ends up, you know, you pick and choose the best terms from the various, you know, nefarious characters that you meet from all over the world.
Mate, could I just ask you, just going back to this old film stock, I notice you have your stuff seems to have, from what I can see, and I'm pretty colorblind, it seems to have a teal and orange sort of look to it. If I got completely
That's interesting.
Yeah, colorblind, Carmen.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I don't know. I really like color in general, but I wouldn't say. Intentionally. Film, especially at night, and it depends on the film stock that I'm using too, it can take on like a cool shadow, warm highlight kind of split tone, and that's just something that film does a bit, but. Yeah, that's interesting. It's just your monitor calibration. I'm not sure.
It might be my mind calibration, actually, Chris.
Carmen is actually colorblind. That's it's a real thing.
That's my excuse. Everything's teal and orange. Everything's teal and orange in my world.
So that's a question that you ask everyone, no matter what.
It's not, but I'm going to write.
I just shoot black and white. I'm not sure what you're looking at there.
Here's a question for you. What's more important to you, composition or light?
Well, that's interesting. I think both. Because I think a photograph of just interesting light without any sort of interesting composition is not going to be a compelling photograph, and I think that a photo that's just composition and no light is going to be equally as uncompelling. I don't know. I think both. I'm pretty, I don't know, maybe composition. I'm pretty aware of what I'm putting in the four corners of my frame, and it's not always about the sort of dramatic light moment capture that maybe a street photographer would be looking for, or a wedding or a portrait photographer where like really the light is the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Like definitely I need to have, I'm pretty sort of staunchly rigid in that verticals need to be vertical, horizontals need to be horizontal. And also the light needs to be good, but I, you know, I'm never going to take a picture that's crooked or half-assed just because the light was good, I don't think, but.
Yeah. So what is it about this urban banal style that you like? Is it, what draws you to that? Is it about telling stories? Is it just about photographing things before they go, or what?
I think it started off as a way for me to kind of connect with a new place. 'Cause this is like, I think 4,000 or 5,000 kilometers from my home and moved here a while ago. And it never quite felt like home. Mm. And so I sort of, when I bought my first camera originally, whatever it was, 8 years ago, it was to take pictures of my, at the time, unborn son. He has since been born and has been growing steadily since then. Mm. But then it sort of evolved into various ways that I can use my camera to connect with the things around me. And so that's always been pictures of my family and that kind of candid stuff. And then it was, I sort of did more like night sky, aurora and Milky Way things. And then the sort of obnoxious HDR cityscape stuff for a while.
Oh, I love those. Yeah. Great photos. HDR.
Yeah. which I think is more just a way to learn, you know, camera settings and the technical side of how things work. And I think that's an example of, you know, learning the extreme ends of what your camera can do. Mm. But it informs, you know, your photography as you move forward. Mm. But then I think I started to, you know, once you run out of that kind of stuff and you can't just shoot aurora and Milky Way all the time. And, and so I started to sort of challenge myself to look at the world around me and find beauty and find interest or stories, in the what other people would think as boring things around me, whether it was walking down a back alley of my street or going for a drive to, you know, these other towns and just kind of appreciating these scenes that where others might pass them by, but they're things that are a part of our everyday lives nonetheless.
And do you sell many prints? Are you I saw on your website you do have a section where you can buy prints, the limited edition stuff.
I mean, some days more than others.
Yep.
I was with a gallery for a while and sold some with them, and then after COVID they went out of business, and so since then I've done some sales on my own, and I sort of get, you know, requests from people to print various images of things from the Instagram feed, but that's something that I haven't sort of put a concerted effort behind. It's I found that most of the joy for me in taking photos can just be going for a drive and exploring, and you know, sometimes I won't even look at the pictures for months afterwards. It's just the act of doing it is kind of my mental exercise, and I mean, the ultimate goal obviously would be to sell Gregory Crutzen size and price prints, but a million bucks. You know, I do have a full-time day job, so luckily I don't, I sort of use the photography prints and money to feed the habit more than anything. So,
all right.
Do you get the kids at school to critique your work, mate? Do they understand what you're doing?
Actually, it's probably not a bad idea.
Sorry?
And I teach kids that are young enough. They're just like, this is boring. I don't know why. Why would you take a picture of this weird old whatever? They don't really give a shit about that kind of stuff. But I take lots of pictures of them too, which is a lot of fun and keeps me on my toes. But it's definitely, you know, you get used to being immersed in this kind of art world or in whatever art bubble that you're in, where shooting this stuff is quite normal. Mm-hmm. And you know, the people that are around you are used to it. But it's always funny when either someone finds you taking a picture of something. So I'll backtrack a bit here. One of my favorite things that can happen when I'm out taking photos is if someone walks up to you or walks by you and sees you photographing something, sees you pointing your camera at something, and they look at you and they look at whatever you're taking a picture of, and they look back at you with this confused look on their face. Like, why the hell are you taking a photo of that? Like, that's not, it's not something that registers to them as something worth documenting.
I get that all the time. I get that all the time.
It's not a dramatic mountain landscape. It's not a, you know, a beautiful woman on the hood of a car. And, you know, to a lot of people, that's what photos are. And so that's one of my favorite things is sometimes having to explain that, be it, you know, police officers that stop you at night and they're like, what are you doing? And you're like, well, I'm taking a picture of the back of this motel or whatever. And they're like, nice try. What are you actually doing? You're like, I don't know. I have a tripod with a camera on it. I can't break this down for you anymore. But
I get that all the time too. And it's only Christian Fletcher going, mate, why are you taking that photo?
What are you doing, Carmen? Why are you shooting that photo?
Mate, look, just getting back to your prints, I've got two questions for you. Firstly, if folks want to buy your stuff, how do they do it?
Yeah. Lately I've been doing it just by contacting me directly. And then I sort of handle that a la carte. And I've got a couple of sort of common sizes that I do and kind of prices for each size. And then I'll print them off like in editions for each print. But yeah, they can just reach out to me directly, you know, whether it's through the website or my Instagram account works just as well.
Mm. And how much?
How much are the prints?
Yeah.
Anywhere from, I do sort of 11 by 17s for about $250 up to, and I've got sort of a metric that's like height plus width times 10, basically to scale that up or down. But that's sort of the smallest size print that I do. And then my last show was up to prints that were like 40, they're all 40 inches by 50 inches. So nice and big. And that's one of the benefits of shooting in, whether it's medium format film or large format film, is you can print really, really big if you get those, if you scan the film at full resolution. You know, a 40 by 50 inch print is very obtainable without owning a, you know, 100 megapixel phase one or something. It's it's pretty nice.
Speaking of camera systems, what's your digital, you know, what's in your digital wheelhouse?
I've had a few over the years. I've always shot Canon mainly. Started on a Canon 5D2.
Yes.
Cameron loves his 5D2.
Oh, yes.
Man, I would still be shooting a 5D2, but it was, stolen out of my car last year.
Oh no!
Mine's actually
like on the that. One night I left it in a bag in my car. Someone popped in through the door and made away with it. That and a couple of other lenses, and that was pretty devastating. But so, I mean, over the years, I've got I just sold. I had an older Phase One for a while, a P45 Plus, which is their older sensor. It's probably 12 or 14 years old now.
Wow. Yeah.
But I bought it from a local guy that I think had shot less than 1,000 frames with it.
Okay.
And I bought it for a pretty reasonable price at the time. I think it was $3,500 or $4,000. I think he paid $20,000 for it.
Yeah, of course.
And I shot that for a while. And one of the cool things about that system was the body that I had for it, is the Phase One DF Plus, which is the same body as the older Mamiya 645 body. So you could shoot Mamiya 645 glass on that one instead of buying like the $8,000 Schneider lenses. And they were beautiful. And those older sensors on the P45 Plus, they're, I don't know if you're familiar with CCD sensors instead of the more modern CMOS sensors. And they were much more limited in what you could do with them. Like anything above ISO 200 was actual dog shit, like unusable. But at ISO 50 or 100, it was insane. Like like the most latitude I've ever seen and looked as close to film as I've ever seen a digital system look. So that was the main draw for me, was I could go out and shoot projects and have a digital copy, a medium format and full size medium format, not like the crop sensor GFX medium format, like full sensor medium format film copy of the picture and then my film version as well. So it was a great way to shoot for a few years. And then And then I was approached in the summertime from a guy that that was very interested in the system. So I ended up selling it to him because it just, yeah, wasn't meeting my needs necessarily anymore. Like, you know, digitally, the autofocus was not very good. It didn't have a live view option. So it was difficult. Pretty limited. Yeah. And those things are coming to the end of their lives. And that's an age of a camera system that if it stops working, it just turns into a paperweight.
Yeah,
like there's no servicing it. It's just done. And so now my main digital rig is a Canon 5D3 and a few lenses for that. And that's sort of the main digital setup.
Yeah.
What do you guys shoot?
Well, Carmen's got the Panasonic S1R.
Lumix S1R, which is...
That's a popular video setup, is it not?
I think the SR is the video one, but this is the one that does pixel shift, which is 187 megapixels.
Excellent.
So, and Christian's got the SL2 with the Summicron.
Yeah, I'm using the Leica.
Fancy.
So I've got all the Leica lenses and stuff. I was shooting Phase One for a while. I had a P65 Plus, and then I upgraded to the IQ 280. I actually got a 180, and then I got the 280.
Yeah,
and then in the last year and a half, I sold all that gear, got rid of it all, and went straight over to Leica and got the.
So, what made you switch from the IQ stuff to the Leica system?
Exactly what you just said. I you couldn't use it above 200 ISO, even 200 was dodgy. So I couldn't focus, and my eyesight's getting worse and worse. So no proper live view. The IQ 280 had a live view, but it was ridiculous. Didn't work. So I was finding it. I was missing shots. I couldn't do it. That again was a CCD sensor, so I couldn't do any night stuff. I was out with people that were doing stars and auroras and everything else, and I was just like,
That's not the wheelhouse for those cameras for sure.
Nah. But you're right about the look and the fact. I mean, that's still my IQ 280 still had some of the best files I've ever seen on a camera.
Oh, 100%. And you would zoom into them at 100%. And it would look like you could still keep zooming in. They're unbelievable looking files.
Yeah, they're great. So, but now I'm with Leica. I can shoot pretty much everything. And that's still great. And I'm using the Summicron lenses now. So, it's to me that's approaching what I was getting with my Phase. It's got pixel shift as well. So that's called a multi-shot mode. So that spits out 187 megapixel file if I want it. And
that's lots.
Yeah, and it does a really good job of that as well. So, I could make, we're in meters here, so 2 meters by
3 meters prints,
and they just look superb. So, but you don't make those all the time,
No, you'd like to, wouldn't you? But it's, the market for those is fairly limited. But there's nothing like a large scale print like that. It's just, I am a big fan.
Yeah, and what you do lends itself to being large. You know, that's part of it as well. You got this hyper real look, this beautiful detailed file, massive print. It becomes immersive. Then you're looking at it, and you can walk into that print, and that's
There's something about scenes that are a little less. Like, I mean, Instagram lends itself very well to big pops of color, really flashy images, and I find a lot of the time those are the ones that do the best on that platform, because people are, you're looking at it and it's a 3-inch wide square on your phone or whatever. And that's not always the best for what I shoot, definitely for me personally, I always shoot with a print in mind, not, an Instagram banger in mind, so sometimes what gets posted on Instagram is not necessarily what I think would be the best prints and vice versa.
Sure. Now, do you go out shooting on your own most of the time, or do you go out with people? Do you have mates that like to shoot with you and that sort of stuff?
I do. We've got a really strong photo community in Calgary, and so I shoot fairly regularly with other people, and my girlfriend Raquel is a really talented photographer too, and she shoots similar subject matter to me, so we go on a lot of photo trips together. But I find that I really enjoy shooting with other people, but I don't produce my best work when I'm shooting with other people.
We've actually got quite a strong photographic community here too. Chris, in actual fact, Christian, I was just thinking, my camera is an L-mount system, and so is yours. So watch this, Chris. I'll demonstrate how strong our community is. Mate, can I borrow your Summicron, Fletch?
No fucking way.
You see. Anyway, sorry, back to you.
You can have my oldest child, but you can't have my Summicron.
there's your quote of the episode right there.
Yeah, I knew that would happen.
That's worth a try. I mean, we our friends around here, I've got lots of buddies that we trade gear with all the time.
Yep.
And a lot of the time it is gear that you're like, oh, I shouldn't drop this because I can't afford to replace it, so I better give it back soon.
Actually, that is really interesting, because I've been following one of these subreddits, one of these photography things, and it was one of the questions was, would you ever lend gear to anybody? I probably would. I'd probably lend someone like Christian or Tony a lens, but I probably wouldn't just lend it to anybody, if that makes sense. Mm. And that is if they specifically needed it for something. I wouldn't, because all it takes is just one drop and then you get a scratch. And I don't know what you guys think about that, but it would be a no from me.
I mean, look, if you wanted to borrow a car, and I could, I could possibly wrap some foam around it.
And you would have to be there with me.
Yeah. You know what I'm like. I'm a little bit,
And you'd be critical of the shot too. I'd be like setting up a shot of my car keys. You'd be like, oh, you're not sure about that light car, Juanos.
But, yeah, that's you're wearing out my glass, man, with those images. Stop it.
So they'll be art one time.
You only get so many shots per lens.
That's right.
Is that true? Exactly. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, that
actually,
makes
sense. The lenses do go off. They do lose sharpness.
Do they?
Over time, apparently.
Really?
According to Les Walking, they do, yeah. So,
He would know.
That's just something that Leica tells you.
Yeah, that's right. You must buy this new one. Your one's... How old is it? Yeah. Oh, it's a year old. Okay, yes, it's definitely lost some sharpness now.
Yeah, it's a bit high in the cardboard case.
They love me.
But, I mean, I've borrowed... I remember one of my first times I ever borrowed gear from someone. I was shooting a wedding, and so I borrowed a friend's 70-200 2.8, which, like, at the time for me was, like, an astronomically... I mean, it still is an astronomically expensive lens.
That's a nice piece of glass, too, by the way. That's
beautiful piece of glass. But it's probably $3,500 or something like that. And, I mean, it's giant and quite limited if that's... Like, that's generally not a focal length that I shoot all the time, but it's a tremendous lens for shooting events, for shooting weddings, for some telephoto work. But so I had borrowed this, and I was taking it out. I went to the park with my son, and I was testing it out just to get a feel for it the day before. And so the whole park is grass, except for the one pavement bike path. And I was walking toward the bike path, and I had it in my hands, and something happened, and I tripped. And I tossed the camera and the lens. And I just remember seeing it slow motion come out of my hands. And I swiped at it with both arms and missed. And it hit the ground. And that lens ripped the whole inside of the camera out. And destroyed it. Like, absolutely destroyed it. So I had to send the camera away to get fixed. And I had to send the lens away to get fixed. And it was something like $2,600 to get them both fixed, just so that I could give my friend her lens back and say thank you. I could have bought the fucking lens myself for the same price used, but instead dropped it when I had borrowed it on the first day.
Fletch, I don't want to borrow your lens anymore, mate. You can have that Summicron.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. I'm happy with that, Carwin. That sounds good to me.
Yeah,
if you weren't taking photos, mate, what would you be doing? In your time off, obviously.
Ice hockey,
in
obviously.
My spare time, well, you know what? I used to spend like every waking hour just obsessing about photography stuff, and I dove in with 2 feet. And since then, the last couple of years, I've been spending less time on it. So I still shoot. I'm probably out every 2 weeks at least, but just trying to spend some time living a little bit more of a balanced life. So I spend a lot of time with my two sons and with my girlfriend, and I love to cook and that kind of stuff as well, and just spending more time with friends and things in the last 2 years. So I'm as happy with a beer on the couch with you know, with my neighbor and my friends shooting the breeze as I have been in a long time. So sort of a variety of things.
Mm. Yeah, right. So so if you're not taking the photos, you're out getting pissed. Okay, that sounds good.
Well, lately it has been in getting pissed, not out because of COVID. Right. But right, the sentiment's the same.
Yeah, yeah, good stuff. Right. Well, look, it's been a pleasure chatting and getting to know you. And look, if Carmen and I ever get over to Canada, we're coming to see you. You're gonna have to take us to some of these cool places that you've got all to yourself.
Yeah, we'll borrow.
Yeah, can't show up in your old dope van, though.
we'll borrow some of your lenses while we're there.
Yeah, yes, perfect. Perfect.
Yeah, but I won't be able to. I won't have any of my own with me, so I won't be able to reciprocate. Sorry about that.
Sorry, boys. I forgot my wallet. Whose shout is it?
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Yeah. Oh, that happens here too.
Yeah, but thanks for your time, mate. And I know it's getting late over there now. It's probably, 9 o'clock, 9:30?
Yeah, 20 to 10.
20 to 10, wow. Yeah, you've got to go get some sleep.
And some beer.
You know, I would have been in bed an hour ago. I go to bed pretty early, get up pretty early these days. So,
you and I both. Well, I appreciate you guys having me on. And, happy shooting down under there. And I'll speak to you soon.
Yeah, no worries, mate. If you're ever down this way too... you know, and you've got a negative COVID test, come and see us.
Sounds good. Sounds good.
Good stuff. All right. Well, Chris thanks, Malloy. Boys. We will see you all in the future somewhere.
Thanks, Chris.
Cheers.